Great. So I'm really delighted to be here and to have a chance to tell you about the work that we're doing in my lab. And I'm particularly excited to be here because this question that you see, that's my title, is really the central question that's driving our research now. And it's a question that came about for us because of interactions I had outside of the context of academia. So I've actually been studying and trying to understand how children respond when other kids are mean to them for about 10 years now, which is frightening to me, but it's true. So for about 10 years. And when I started, it was really a tool for me to answer basic questions about what social competence is and how we can understand that. And what happened was, whenever people would ask me or make the mistake of asking me what I study, you should never ask an academic what they study. Whenever people would make this mistake, I would tell them, and they would say to me, "Fantastic, I know this little girl who's getting picked on. What should I tell her to do?" And I realized that we actually didn't yet have a great answer to that. And that answering that question, as I'm going to show you, is, I think, of tremendous public health significance, given the extent to which children actually experience aggression at the hands of their classmates. So that's really the direction we're going. And as I said, it's come about through interactions I've had outside of academia as well as with my colleagues. And so I'm really pleased to be here tonight and to hear your questions. So just to give you an overview, I'm going to start by telling you about the scope of the problem, what aggression among children looks like, how common it is. I'm going to tell you a little bit about how we can understand what social competence is and how we can start to figure out what effective responses to peer aggression are. I'm going to tell you a little bit about what we know about how children do respond when they experience aggression by their peers. And then I'm going to talk about which of these strategies are effective. Okay, so let's talk about the scope of the problem. Most of you probably remember being in elementary or middle school, and you probably more recently than that have parented a child going through elementary or middle school. And so I'm not telling you something new when I tell you that children can be unbelievably mean to each other, and they can do it in a shocking number of diverse and creative ways. And so we see physical attacks between children, so children hitting each other, kicking each other, damaging each other's property. We see them threatening to do physical harm to other people. We see them verbally taunting and making fun of and teasing other kids, maybe about their appearance, about how well they're doing at school, about how badly they're doing at school. We also start to see children manipulating their social relationships in really nasty and unfortunate ways. So freezing somebody out because you're mad at them, trying to get other people to stop talking to somebody. Trying to get other people to stop, I like that one so much, I'm going to show it twice. And increasingly, we're seeing social media get used. So leaving mean messages all over somebody's Facebook page for other people to read. Sending nasty text messages to other kids. So I'm going to focus on the type of aggression that we see actually occurring between kids. I'm not going to talk about cyberbullying, which is a whole other lecture in and of itself. And so looking at those examples I showed you, you can see that we're really dealing with three types of aggression between children. So physical aggression, where you're threatening somebody's physical well-being or maybe their property. Verbal aggression, where you're saying nasty things. And relational aggression, where you're threatening or manipulating somebody else's social relationship. So you're deliberately excluding them, you're spreading nasty rumors about them. So how often do children experience this? The answer is a lot. So estimates from the literature that between 30% to 60% of children report being targeted aggressively or victimized at least once in the last year at school. And that 6 to 15% of children report that they're being victimized weekly or more frequently than that. So most children will experience this sometimes. Some children will experience it a lot. So to put you in a local context, these are data that we've actually collected as part of a longitudinal project that we're running here in Montreal. So this is work we've done with about 580 children who are in Sec 1 or grade 7, so about 13 years of age. And what we did, what I'm showing you here, is we just figured out, we asked them, have you been victimized in the last year at school. So you can see when you look at these numbers that 67% of boys report that they've been physically victimized in the last year, and 41% of girls, that 74% of boys report that they've been relationally victimized in the last year at school, and 80% of girls, and that 81% of boys report that they've been verbally victimized, and 76% of girls. So there's a couple of things that I want you to notice about these numbers. One is, again, that they're high. So most children are experiencing this at least once in the last year at school. Because the focus here is gender, I want you to take a look at this line, where girls are reporting, 80% of girls are reporting being relationally victimized, and 74% of boys are reporting being relationally victimized. There's a perception that this is something that only girls do, that girls are mean to each other like this, and boys don't do this. That isn't true. So you can see 74% of the boys are reporting that at least once somebody has spread a rumor about them or tried to leave them out. And that's consistent with what we see in the broader literature, that relational aggression does happen among boys, that this is not just something that happens to girls. Boys do experience physical victimization. So again, things like being pushed or shoved, they do experience that at higher rates than girls do. Okay, so to put you just briefly in the broader developmental context, those figures I showed you were for children in grade 7, SEC 1. We do see higher rates of physical and verbal aggression earlier in development that decline as children get older, and rates of relational aggression peak later than rates of physical and verbal aggression, but also decline with age. So those children are in grade 7. We're following them for another 2 years. I would expect those numbers to come down as they move through grade 8 and through grade 9. Okay, so I think what I've demonstrated is that, unfortunately, this is very common. And it's a high-stakes situation. This is very stressful. It's very hard to deal with. And so it's important that we figure out what children can do. How can they manage this in a way that's effective? To answer that question, we need to understand what we mean by that. What do we mean when we say that their management of the situation was socially competent? Thinking broadly, social competence is effectiveness in interpersonal interactions. More specifically, it's somebody's judgment on the basis of certain criteria that a person's performance on some task is adequate. So if we look at that definition of social competence, you can see that there are actually four factors that are going to contribute to social competence. So the first is behavior. What do you actually do? And you can imagine that on average, some behaviors are likely to be better than others. Knowing nothing else, if your child came home and told you that they had shared with somebody, you'd probably be happier than if they came home and told you that they'd kicked somebody. So on average, some behaviors will be better than others, and behavior is clearly going to contribute to the competence of in the situation. The second is that it's a person who's enacting the behavior. And the same behavior enacted by two different people is very likely to be met with a different response. So I'm going to give you an example to show you what I mean. This is my nephew, Brady, going out for Halloween the year he was 2. And his parents tried really hard, and they practiced a lot, but Brady could not quite master saying trick or treat. And so his solution to this problem was to thrust that orange pumpkin bucket at people and say, "More, more." This was unbelievably effective. I had a nice objective indicator. We ate candy for weeks after this was over. But Brady was only 2. You can imagine that if a 5-year-old had done that, we probably would have found it less charming. And so there's an interaction here between the child and the behavior. The same behavior enacted by two different people is not going to be equally as effective. The third thing we have to think about is the task. What exactly, what situation are you trying to manage? Again, the same behavior in different situations is likely to be met with different levels of success. So we're focused today on understanding how children respond to peer provocation. This requires a different set of behaviors than other challenging circumstances that children might have to manage. And being able to manage this situation competently doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to see success in other types of situations that have different demands. And the fourth thing is that it's a judgment. For us to say that behavior is effective, somebody has to make that call. Someone has to say, this was competent. And there's going to be variability between people in terms of their perceptions of the competence. So who's judging, who's evaluating is also going to play a role in whether or not behavior is seen to be as effective. Okay. So keeping those four factors in mind, let's turn to the question of how children respond to aggression by peers. So here what we're really thinking about when we think about the four factors is what behaviors are they using to manage this specific situation, the specific situation of having to respond when another child aggresses against you. So how then are we going to answer this question? It's mini science, and so I can't resist a brief methodological digression. So one way to answer this question is to use observational approaches. So we can watch what children do, and developmental psychologists have learned an enormous amount about children's behavior from using these types of approaches. So one thing you can do is you can set up very specific situations and you can watch how children handle them. So for example, there's been beautiful work done watching what children do to enter a peer group to play. So what kind of bids do they use so that the other kids will let them play? So we can learn a lot about children's behavior from observing them in very specific situations. We can also observe them more naturalistically, for example, by going to school and watching them. And researchers, again, have developed really creative and interesting approaches to doing this, including putting wireless mics like the one I'm wearing on children so that you can actually hear them when you're not there, which gives you access to a whole bunch of behaviors that might be really hard for you to see. So we've learned a lot about children's behavior by using direct observation. I'm going to talk to you about a different approach that we use in my lab, which is having children respond to vignettes describing hypothetical social situations. And I like this compared to observations in my work for a couple of reasons. One is that often in observational work, you can really only look at one situation. And we know that behavior changes a lot as a function of situation. So using vignettes gives me a chance to find out how children would manage multiple different situations. So that's one reason that I like to use it. The second reason is that when you're interested in aggression among children, this is actually still a fairly low base rate behavior. It happens, but it doesn't happen every hour, for example. And so it can actually be hard to observe enough interactions to get a really rich understanding. So for those reasons, right now what we're using is hypothetical vignettes. So let me show you an example. Poor Dean Grant has seen this so many times. I think he must be very sick of it. So this is the kind of story that we would read to kids, and we play it on a video, on a recording for them so that it's a standardized presentation. You're walking back into your classroom after picking something up at the principal's office for your teacher. As you enter, you overhear two girls talking about you. One girl tells the other that you did something really mean to her on the way home from school. The other girl is shocked and says that she's surprised anyone is friends with you. You know that you didn't do what the girl said. What would you say or do? Okay, so what would you say or do? What could you do in that situation? Sorry. There's a lot of answers. Okay, go ahead. Sorry? Yeah, okay, what would you say, though? Be more specific.
Why would you say that?
Okay, so you would ask her why. I heard cry somewhere else. What else could we do?
Cry.
Oh, okay. What else? Yeah, you could just ignore it, right? You could just walk away and not do anything. So children do all of these things. So let me show you some actual responses from participants in our studies. So I would confront them, but I would say, I didn't do that. I would probably go up to the person and say, why are you lying about me? So that's asking why, but it's a slightly more aggressive version of that. I would just say that she's lying, and then I would make up something about her. Okay, so this person's retaliating in kind. I'd probably just ignore it. I would beat her up. I would, seriously. Okay, so those are all real answers. And as you can imagine, I have boxes and boxes in my lab full of transcripts of answers children have given to these stories. And in order for us to use them, we actually have to be able to code them into meaningful categories. And so we've actually developed a coding system for their responses that has 8 categories. So physical aggression, so for example, I would shove him or her back. Verbal aggression, I would yell at him or her. Ending relationship with the aggressor, so I would never speak to her again, ever. Damaging the aggressor's relationship with others, so I would tell people stories about her. Or I would get all of our friends onto my side. Doing nothing, so I would just walk away, just ignore it. Seeking an explanation, which was the example given over here, I would ask him why he did that. Telling an adult, so I would go and I would get the teacher. And crossing personal limits, which is this is a verbally assertive strategy in which you communicate explicitly to the person that what they did is not okay with you. So I would tell him or her to apologize to me, or I would tell him or her not to do it again. So we have these 8 categories, and an important thing to note here is that they are not mutually exclusive. So a lot of children actually give really complex responses that involve more than one of these. And so, for example, we often see the combination of verbal aggression and seeking an explanation. So they're going to ask why, but they're going to do it in a more amped up way than you might see from a grown-up. So instead of saying, why did you do that, I might say, what's your problem? And we know from our work that those strategies actually fit into 3 broader categories of aggressive responding, avoidant responding, and assertive responding. So physical aggression, verbal aggression, and damaging the aggressor's relationship with others are aggressive responses. Ending the relationship with the aggressor and doing nothing are avoidant. You're not actually confronting the person or trying to do anything. And seeking an explanation, stating that the provocation crossed limits, and the combination of seeking an explanation and verbal aggression are all verbally assertive strategies. Now, I've always been interested in the fact that for children, they do perceive this as assertive, which I think is developmentally fascinating because I bet most of you don't. I bet if I said to you, what's your problem, you would hear that as being fairly aggressive. And so I suspect that there's a shift somewhere over development where that starts to be being perceived as an aggressive response, but for children in 7th grade, it's not. You see it fitting together with these assertive strategies. And we don't actually find that telling an adult really fits with any of the other ones, and so we always treat this one differently. Interestingly, again, I would expect developmental differences, and so I know from work with younger children, so children who are in grades 2 and 3, that actually fits with the assertive strategies. So for younger children, this might be more assertive. Older children don't see it that way. Okay, so we know what children do. How common are these responses? Which responses are the go-to strategies? So again, these are data that we've collected here. 579 children in Sec 1 in English-speaking schools in Montreal, half female, average age of 13 years. And what we did to answer this question was we gave them a multiple choice measure that has 11 of stories, like the story I showed you, all describing physical, verbal, or relational provocation. Each of those stories is then paired with 9 possible strategies. There's 1 from each of the coding categories, so there's a physically aggressive one, a verbally aggressive one, and there's 1 combining verbal aggression and seeking an explanation. And again, we put that on because that is actually a very commonly used strategy for children. And so we wanted to make that a choice. Okay, so what's your problem? And then what children are asked to do is identify every strategy they would actually use in response to that situation. And again, we let them pick more than one if they want to, because a lot of children do that. They give more complex responses that combine multiple strategies. Okay, so in what I think is good news, by far the most common strategies is to just do something assertive. So to use seeking an explanation, stating that the provocation crossed limits, or the combination of seeking an explanation and verbal aggression. So 33% of all responses were just assertive. 13% were just aggressive. So using physical aggression or verbal aggression, or damaging the aggressor's relationship with others. 17% combined assertion and aggression. And again, oops, I want to go back. Note that that's more common than just aggression. So what you see more commonly is for children to combine assertion and aggression. Avoidance only is less common at 11%. And then almost nobody relies on telling a teacher at this age. So only 2% of responses involved only going to an adult. Now, again, that would be higher with younger children. Younger children do this more often. But by seventh grade, this is not a strategy on which they rely. And then the rest of these are other combinations of responses that aren't frequent enough to examine. Do boys and girls use different responses? So we have a sense of the general picture of what strategies they use. Do they use different responses? So consistent with what I showed you in terms of victimization experience and also with the broader literature, boys are more likely to endorse physically aggressive responses. So what you're seeing here up this axis is the number of situations in which that particular strategy was endorsed. So there are 11 situations, so you have 11 chances to say, I would hit him back. And boys average twice. In two of the situations, they say, I would be physically aggressive. Girls are at a much lower level than that. So boys are more likely to rely on physical aggression than are girls. Girls are more likely than boys to use the assertive strategies. And again, they're more likely to seek an explanation, they're more likely to state that the provocation crossed limits, and they're more likely to use this combination of seeking an explanation and verbal aggression. And this is consistent with the broader literature in that a lot of work has demonstrated that girls are more socially skillful than boys. They're more likely to engage in prosocial behaviors than boys, and here we're seeing they're more likely to use the assertive responses, which, as I'm going to show you, are generally considered to be the more effective responses. So we do see gender differences in strategy use. Okay, so that gives you a sense of what children are doing when other kids are mean to them. Again, you can think about it in three broad categories: assertive, aggressive, avoidant. The most common response is to respond with assertion, but we do see aggression and avoidance at fairly high rates. So knowing what children do, the next question becomes, okay, which of these strategies are effective? What's going to work? What's going to be competent when you're responding to aggression by peers? Okay, so remember that when we're thinking about responding to aggression by peers, we're thinking about the specific behaviors used to manage a specific task. When we think about effectiveness, now we're adding in the component of who's judging, because I expected that we would see differences depending on who we asked. That's actually a really important question clinically, and I'm going to show you why. We also start to get into the issue of who's enacting the behavior, and do we get differences in perceptions of competence depending on, for example, if an older or younger child uses this strategy, or if a boy or a girl uses this strategy. Okay, so we were particularly interested in the beginning to think about how children perceive these strategies and how their teachers perceive these strategies, because we expected that they were going to have differences between them in terms of what they perceive to be effective responses. And that is important from an intervention perspective, because if kids perceive it differently, if they have a different perception of what's effective than grown-ups do, then we don't just want to go in and teach them to use the adult-sanctioned responses, because it may not work when they're interacting with other kids. So we need to know how this is being perceived in other peer groups. It's also interesting clinically because it's possible that what children are really having to do is manage what's a very challenging multi-constraint problem, which is trying to come up with a response that's effective from the perception of multiple different people. So you've got to respond. The other kids think you should do one thing, and the grown-ups think you should do something else. It's hard, potentially, to find a response that's going to satisfy both groups. And that's something that we need to think about when we're working with children clinically. So in the beginning, we started by looking at how youth and teachers, two groups of individuals, both in a position to reward or punish the behavior of children at school, how they perceived children's responses to aggression by peers. And we wanted to know, do youth and teachers differ in their perceptions of the effectiveness of responses to peer aggression? We also want to know which strategies do youth and teachers think are most effective. So what do other kids think you should do if somebody shoves you back or somebody shoves you on the playground? And finally, again, thinking about the idea that behavior, the effectiveness of behavior, could vary as a function of who's enacting it, do we see that the effectiveness of strategies varies as a function of child characteristics? So particularly here of gender and of age. Okay, so this was work I did actually before I got here, and this was done with 664 youth in grades 6, 7, and 8, and with 49 of their teachers. And what we did was we gave them six stories, again, just like the one I showed you that's actually taken right from the measure, describing physical, verbal, and relational aggression by children. And we paired each of them with responses representing the eight categories that I described previously. So you got the situation, and you got a list of responses that a child might use if this had happened to them. And then what everybody was asked to do is they were asked to rate how well is this going to work to solve the problem. So here's the situation, here's a response. How well will this work to solve the problem on a scale from 1 to 5? 5 being, I think it would work really well. Okay. So remember that our first question was, do we think that will children and teachers differ in their perceptions of the effectiveness of behaviors? And this graph is actually showing you that the answer to that is yes. So up the axis, we have the mean effectiveness ratings going from 1, this would not work at all, to 5, this would work really well. And so right here, these are the aggressive responses, and you can see in every case, children think that is a much more effective thing to do than teachers do. It's for physical aggression, for verbal aggression, and for damaging the aggressor's relationship with others. It's also true for ending relationship with the aggressor, which is an avoidance strategy. Children think that's a more effective response than teachers do, and it reverses for seeking an explanation, the assertive response, where teachers perceive that to be more effective than do youth. So as we expected, we are seeing differences between teachers and youth in their perceptions of the effectiveness of youth responses. Probably the most notable and the one we expected was in the aggressive responses, where grown-ups do not think these are going to be effective. And what was interesting to me is the question is, do you think this will be effective? Not do you think this is a good thing to do, because you could think it's effective and still not sanction it. They really don't think it's going to work. So let me show you another interesting difference between youth and teachers that I actually think is particularly interesting clinically. So this is showing you the effectiveness rating. Again, 5 being is going to work really, really well. This is showing you the ratings for verbal aggression, the combination of verbal aggression and seeking an explanation, and just seeking an explanation. So when you go from just being verbally aggressive, so for example, just yelling at the other kid, to verbal aggression and seeking an explanation, so yell, but also ask why amongst the yelling, that improves the effectiveness rating of both children and their teachers. Watch when you take out the verbal aggression. So now we're going from that combination of being verbally aggressive and seeking an explanation to just seeking an explanation. Teacher ratings go up, so that really buys you something from the perspective of an adult in terms of the effectiveness of the response. It doesn't actually help that much when you're being perceived by other children. Children do not see just seeking an explanation as more effective than the combination of verbal aggression and seeking an explanation. So clinically, what this suggests to me possibly is that spending a lot of time helping children to pull back the verbal aggression from these responses may not be buying you that much from the perspective of other children. It's potentially going to be a problem in interactions with adults, but for interacting with other children, they're not really seeing a difference here, at least in terms of their perceptions of the effectiveness of the response. So we are seeing interesting differences between teachers and youth in their ratings. That doesn't really answer the question, though, of what do they think is the most effective thing to do. So which responses do they see to be the most effective? So this graph is showing you the teacher ratings across the different strategies. And what you can clearly see when you look at this is that they don't think that the aggressive strategies are effective. They think that the assertive strategies are effective as well as telling an adult. So we're seeing that they really think these are markedly more effective than relying on aggressive responses. So what about kids? We know that kids think that aggression is more effective than the teachers do, but do they think that aggression is as effective as these other less assertive strategies? Boys do, at least for physical aggression. So they see physical aggression to be as effective as seeking an explanation, limit crossing, and telling an adult. So it's not just the case that they think it's more effective than the teachers do. They see it to be equally effective as these other less aggressive responses. They also see ending the relationship with the aggressor as being equally effective as these other types of strategies. So they are seeing this, these aggressive and avoidant responses, as being as effective as assertion. Girls, you don't see it for physical aggression, but you do see it for ending relationship with the aggressor. So for girls, they think ending the relationship with the aggressor is going to work as well as seeking an explanation, as telling the person that they crossed limits, and as telling an adult. So again, we're seeing gender differences here, primarily centered around the physically aggressive response, where boys think that's as good as assertive responses, and girls don't. They perceive that to be less effective. So what about age? Are there differences across age in the strategies that children perceive to be effective? We only found age differences for one strategy, and unsurprisingly, it's telling an adult. So for both youth, and interestingly for teachers, because teachers are told the grade of the child when they're reading the story. So they're told these stories are about children in sixth grade, these stories are about children in grade seven. For both youth and teachers, perceptions of the effectiveness of telling an adult come down with age. And I would expect that if we had younger kids, they would be even higher up. So this becomes increasingly less desirable as children get older. Okay, so let me just sort of summarize where we've been so far. So we know that children and teachers differ in their evaluations of the effectiveness of behavior. We know also that effectiveness varies as a function of child characteristics, that girls have different perceptions about what's effective than boys do, and that the perceptions of at least telling an adult differ as a function of the age of the child enacting the behavior. And so think back to that definition I gave you in the beginning, which is that social competence reflects somebody's judgment on the basis of certain criteria that a person's performance on some task is adequate. So certain criteria. The criteria we have used, or we used in that study, was we asked people to tell us, how effective is this? How well is this going to work to solve the problem? But we left it wide open what the problem was to be solved under those circumstances. And we did that deliberately because we didn't know what children would conceptualize as the problem there. And we were afraid that if we specified very tightly and we didn't get differences, it wasn't because there weren't differences there to be found. It was because we asked the wrong question. So we started with the broad question, but now what we want to do is start unpacking the criteria that underlie those judgments of effectiveness. And there's a lot of criteria that may contribute to people's ratings of how well this is going to work to solve the problem. So for example, one issue might be, how well is this going to work to keep getting along with the person? Particularly if it's aggression happening within a friendship, it might be very important to the child to maintain the relationship. So how well is this going to work if what I want to do is keep getting along? What if I want to get back at the person? For some children, this is a very salient goal, right? They want to get back at the person for what they've done. How well is this going to work to stop my own bad feelings? Some children will feel tremendous negative affect, and what they're going to want to do is find a strategy that makes that stop, that makes them feel better emotionally. How well is this going to work to stop it from happening again? This is the one that I have gotten particularly interested in, again, as a result of conversations that I've been having with friends and also random people that I meet on airplanes. I think we really want to think about which strategies are going to work to de-escalate or stop the harassment that children are experiencing. I want to know which strategies work to stop the aggression. And I want to know that because victimization is associated with negative consequences. So children who are targeted aggressively are more likely to develop depressive symptoms, anxious symptoms, to have difficulty in school. There's a lot of negative consequences. And so anything we can do that helps children learn to manage this in a way that puts a stop to it, I think, is a really important thing to do. What we're seeing right now is that interventions focusing on victimization, a lot of them are really focused at making changes in the broader peer group. So, for example, bystander interventions where you have children learn to intervene when they see other children being picked on or bullied. Those work. There is definitely evidence that they're effective. But I don't think that's the whole story. I think that if we can teach children to learn to manage aggression for themselves and to teach them strategies that they could use that could be effective, that will also be a really valuable thing to do. And so we're increasingly focused on trying to figure out which of these strategies are going to work to stop aggression. Okay, so let's think about the strategies that I've shown you. So there are aggressive strategies, there are avoidant strategies, and there are assertive strategies. Okay, which of these are going to work? Any guesses? Any thoughts? Hypotheses? Sorry? Which is going to work to stop aggression? If I do this, this kid's not going to do it again. Okay, all right. That's definitely the good answer. All right, well, let's take a look at what the literature has suggested so far. So children identify non-victims. Children who are seen as being not victims, they're perceived to be more likely to fight back. So children have the perception that kids who don't get picked on are those who will fight back. The data are not entirely consistent with that perception that children have. So responding with aggression or by seeking revenge may actually escalate the immediate situation. So we know that from observational work done in other labs, that responding with aggression is only going to amp this up. Longer term, it's also associated with stable or increasing victimization over time. So responding aggressively increases victimization as time goes on. Okay, what about avoidant responses? In the moment, avoidance may de-escalate. So it potentially works short term. Long term, it's not so clear. So longer term, some studies have shown that avoidance strategies may increase victimization over time. So even if it de-escalates in the moment, it's not going to stop kids from coming back and doing it again. It should be noted, though, that not everybody has found that. So it's not completely clear from the literature that that's the case. Assertion, which seemed to be the go-to response from the audience, active problem solving, so assertion, does work to de-escalate the immediate conflict. And we've seen that conflict resolution strategies, including telling the person that it's not okay, telling the person to apologize, those are associated with decreased victimization over time. Low levels of assertive behavior, conversely, not using those types of strategies, is associated with increased victimization. Okay, so which strategies work to stop aggression? The story is actually complicated, and you saw that for the avoidance strategies, where some studies were finding it and some studies weren't. And I think the reason for that is the answer is it depends. And you should know what it depends on from what I showed you at the beginning. So it depends on who's doing it. It's not going to work equally well for everybody. So think about gender. Avoidance potentially decreases victimization for girls, but increases it for boys. So this may work better for girls than it does for boys. It's also going to depend on how victimized the child is. So is this a child who has this happen every now and again? Or is this a child who is chronically singled out and harassed by peers? For girls who experience average or high levels of victimization, so girls who get picked on a lot, avoidance just makes it worse over time. It doesn't help them. It works okay for kids for whom this is an occasional thing. But once we're up to people who are having this happen a lot, avoidance doesn't work anymore. Interestingly, for boys experiencing low levels of victimization, so for boys who are only being picked on every now and again, hitting and pushing back is associated with decreased victimization over time. So if it only happens every now and again, and you hit back, that might work for you. It's also going to depend on the situation, right? So again, different situations call for different responses, and some strategies may work for some types of victimization and not for others. So hypothetically, ignoring very low-level verbal aggression might be okay. Ignoring more severe physical provocation might be more of an issue. And so I think that actually the question that I started out asking, which is which strategies work, I don't think it's the right question. I don't think that's actually the question that we need to ask. I think the question that we need to ask is which strategies work for whom and when? Because we're not going to come up with a one-size-fit-all answer that we can just give to everyone. So just coming in and saying, you know what, just ignore it, it'll stop. I don't think that's actually true. I think that could work for some people under some circumstances, and it's going to be the job of researchers to start to delineate that so that we can give much more specific guidance to parents, to children, to clinicians. So where we're taking this in our lab is we are very focused right now on trying to understand assertive responses. I like the assertive responses for a number of reasons. One is that, as I showed you, they're generally perceived as effective by both youth and teachers. And I have data that I'm not showing that suggests a lot of parents like these strategies as well. So these are generally perceived as effective. Youth also think that physical aggression and ending the relationship are effective, but they like these strategies. So these are generally seen by the important players in the social world as being effective. I suggested that there was evidence that these are associated with decreased victimization over time. So we do have suggestion from the literature that these could work in terms of reducing aggression over time. I also think, developmentally, this is an important skill to develop. This is learning to tell people your thoughts, your feelings, in a way that's not aggressive or threatening to them. That is a skill that comes up in a lot of different tasks that you have to manage in your life and as you grow up. And so I think this is an important skill to be able to develop. So what are we doing? One of the questions we want to answer is, are these responses perceived as effective when they're enacted by children at risk for victimization? So experiencing high levels of aggression from other children, it's not random. There are some children who are more likely to get very picked on than others. So children who are in general very aggressive are more likely to be picked on. Children who are struggling with anxiety and depression, they're also more likely to be picked on. So we don't just need to know if assertive responses work, we need to know if they're going to work for those children. And we're worried that they won't. And in part, we're worried that they won't, because they won't be perceived as effective when those children enact them. So as an example, and this is a study that one of my graduate students is running, we're concerned that when a child with a reputation for aggression tries to be assertive, it's just going to be perceived as aggression, right? So imagine a child who's known to be very aggressive saying, "Don't do that again." That could potentially be heard as a threat in a way that it wouldn't be from a child who didn't have that reputation. Conversely, for children who are very anxious, who potentially have a reputation for being withdrawn or for being passive, when they try to do that, it's just going to be seen as passive, right? When they say, "Why did you do that?" it's not going to have what it needs to have to really convince the person to stop. So that's one question we're asking. The second thing we're interested in is, can they actually do it? So independent of their reputation, if we ask them to deliver these types of responses, can they say them in a way that's effective? So we know that for children, once they're past about the age of 10, how the person says it actually carries more meaning than what they're actually saying. So if, for example, children who are very aggressive can't say it in a way that doesn't sound very hostile and very threatening, it's probably not going to work that well. It's not going to be any different than if they delivered a very aggressive response. And so the question isn't just, can assertive responses work? I think on average, they probably can. I think the bigger question, and the question we really have to answer if we're going to help the children who are most at risk, is, can it work for these children? Or are we going to have to come up with another type of strategy for them? Okay, so what should I tell my child? I feel like I need to address this because I get asked so often. And so my graduate students and I, we went over the literature and we tried to come up with what we thought was the most responsible interpretation of the literature to date that we could give you. So the first thing I want to note is that doing nothing may not work. I think that is often the go-to response for grown-ups when children come to them and say, "Somebody's picking on me." I think we often say, "Just ignore it, they'll stop." I don't think that's true in a lot of cases. I think sometimes, maybe, for a child who's not picked on very much, for whom this is an occasional thing, maybe it might work for them. For a lot of children, this is not going to be an effective response. Aggression may not work as well as you think it's going to, and an assertive approach could also be successful. So I think for some children who are getting picked on a lot, they think that aggression will solve this, that if they fight back, it will make it go away. And the data that I showed you suggest maybe not, that for children who are heavily victimized in particular, fighting back is going to exacerbate the problem. So it may not work as well as that you think it's going to in some cases. Now, for some children, it does work, right? There is evidence suggesting that for boys experiencing low levels of victimization, this could be effective. For those people, though, I would say an assertive approach could work for you. You could actually dial that back so we're not teaching them to solve the problem with aggression and have them use one of the more assertive responses. But again, I think the big picture answer here is that it's going to depend. It's going to depend on the specific child. And I think increasingly research is going to focus on answering this more nuanced question about what's going to work for whom, so that we can begin to give much more tailored and specific recommendations. So just to wrap up briefly, I think it's important to sort of take away from this that the effectiveness of behavior varies. It depends on the situation, it depends on who's enacting it, and it depends on who the audience is, who's perceiving it. That's true when we think about helping children manage the social situations in their lives, but it's also true for grown-ups. And it has important implications for treatment, because I think increasingly, as we can get more specific in our understanding of social skills, if we can move away from broad recommendations like "don't be aggressive" or "oh, try to be more assertive," we want to move away from that and towards understanding what are the important situations that children have to manage. Provocation is clearly one. There are others. For example, there are really important situations that come up within children's friendship, like learning how to handle it when a friend disappoints you. That's another situation that children need to learn to manage. So figuring out what situations do they need to learn to manage and what specifically do they need to do to be successful in that situation and what's going to work for that specific child. I think the more we can understand that, the more leverage we're going to have clinically to improve children's social functioning. So let me just wrap up by saying thank you to the funding agencies who have very graciously supported this work, and as well for my students and colleagues who have worked on this with me over the years. Thank you.
Here's a good one. Okay, about siblings. You've got siblings, you know, and one is aggressive and the other is kind of passive.
Right.
How does a parent handle this?
So that's funny. That actually, I have a very good colleague, two very good colleagues at Concordia, Nina Howe and Holly Rekia, who actually are experts in sibling relationships. And so we have actually been talking about that very question, which is, at what point do we know that aggression between siblings is pathological? So some aggression between siblings is totally normative. In fact, it is so normative that we typically use it as a, we typically don't even include it when we're doing clinical assessments. So when we're assessing, for example, for oppositional defiant disorder, one of the questions is, does this child bully other children? And then the next question is, does this only happen with siblings? And if the answer is yes, we don't count it because it's so common between siblings. But there are clearly cases where it is a problem. And so what we're trying to get our hands on is at what point is it indicative that it's a problem and do we actually need to intervene? So is it an older, will the person out themselves? Is it an older sibling hitting on a younger one? Not going to out yourself? Okay. You want to step in, obviously.
Let's assume it's an older one picking on a younger one.
We'll just assume. Okay. Yeah. You obviously want to step in if you think that it's harming the child. And again, sort of thinking about the data that we showed you today, you may want to think about helping that younger child learn to stand up for themselves if they can. In some cases, that won't be possible.
Okay, very good. And sometimes these relationships, they last for a long time.
It's true.
Yeah. Okay, so here's one with very beautiful handwriting, by the way. If research shows that youths find aggression more effective, I guess you said boys, how does that help psychologists? Do they then teach boys to be aggressive instead of assertive? And then how do you go about reducing boys' aggression?
Yeah, great question. So excellent question. And I think I'm glad it was asked because it gives me a chance to clarify, but the argument I am not making is that we should teach children to be aggressive. The argument that I'm making is we need to understand how the behavior is being reinforced in their peer group if we want to have any hope of changing it. So if aggression is working for a child, if it's getting them desired outcomes, if it's getting them to what they want, why are they going to stop? I wouldn't, right? If it's working. And so we need to understand, is this working, before we can think about how are we going to change this. So the idea is not to say, oh, look, a lot of boys think physical aggression is as effective as these other strategies. Let's teach them to do it. The idea is to understand that for some boys, this may be effective. So if we want them to stop, and there's a lot of reasons why we would want them to stop, we may have to take a different tact than just asking them. We may have to give them another strategy that's going to work equally as well, but doesn't do the kind of damage potentially that a physically aggressive response will do. And is also a strategy that, again, developmentally can be useful over the lifespan, because at some point hitting the guy back is not going to work. I'm assuming that doesn't work in administrative scuffles. Is that true? Or does it? Never mind.
Okay. Have you or someone else studied similar situations with, I don't know what's going on here, with individuals who are in university or other groups of children, such as in the Houses of Parliament?
Oh. No, I don't think they'll let me in to the House of Commons. So, you know, we haven't historically. One of the things, one of my graduate students, Miriam Kermeyer, is actually just starting to work on a study now looking at the types of friendship situations that first-year university students go through and how they manage those and what are competent strategies there. So certainly in the context of looking at that, we're seeing a lot of more minor conflict and also possibly some provocation situations that come up for youth who, I don't want to call them kids, youth who are between sort of 18 and 22 years of age. So we're seeing conflicts about fighting over boys and fighting over girls, issues around borrowing things and money. So we're certainly looking at conflict situations in that context.
Is there comparative work to study or show what are the best strategies for adults such as in the room today facing the same sort of problems with aggressive people?
Yeah, so, you know, it's interesting. I don't know if anyone has looked at it in exactly this way. And because of the developmental issues I alluded to, I think it's difficult to generalize sort of up to a different developmental stage. So again, the example I like best to illustrate this point is the example of saying, what's your problem? I think children really hear that basically interchangeably with why did you do that, or they even like it better. They think that's a better response. I don't think that will work with adults. That will be heard as being highly, highly aggressive, potentially. And so because we do, I think, get these really interesting developmental differences in the perception of strategies, we would actually have to redo the work with adults. So again, one of my graduate students is working on something related, so I may have some answers, or she may have some answers in a couple of years.
Okay, and with that, let's thank Melanie again, and I'll see you guys next week.